Yeah, I guess, well, some of you weren't here. We're doing a lot of the Requiem, Mozart's Requiem, this morning, and it's a big deal. We've been rehearsing it for weeks, and it should be good, I think. And we have 30 people. Yeah. I mean, Max has done a wonderful job attracting people, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, there are those of us who've been in the choir forever and ever and ever, but we got a lot of new people and a lot of really young people and good voices, too. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, mm-hmm. I was back there in the bass section on the back row on Thursday, and boy, is that a big sound coming from the back row.
Wow.
I mean, usually there aren't that many of us, so I think I'm kind of more of a factor than I felt that I was on Thursday night.
Because there's a lot of men.
Yeah.
The only thing we don't have enough of is tenors.
True. That's a perennial problem, I think, a lot of times.
We've got several sopranos that can hit the high notes.
Some really good ones, yeah.
lots of basses.
Yep.
It sounds so good when they started with that.
Well, just play more restful to roost that one.
Yeah.
I've been singing that for the whole weekend.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's something in the panel that has such a beautiful voice. I can hear it ringing out so
this
clear
is
and sharp.
Which
one?
I don't know who it is.
Oh, here?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Sometimes I hear that soprano come out so clear and sharp.
We have two or three like that.
Powerful. Yeah, you hear Rebecca.
Yeah, Rebecca.
And Grace is good.
Grace is very good.
She's new.
Yeah.
I don't know where she came from.
She's doing a solo this morning, as a matter of fact. Grace is. And then Rebecca's part of a quartet.
Yeah.
And Gail and then Bill and Ryan.
The usual suspects.
Right, the usual suspects.
Gail, Riley, and Bill.
Yeah.
But Rebecca's the soprano. Yeah,
right.
It's on Thursday, I mean, it's almost scary. It sounded so good on Thursday.
Uh-huh, and you were virtual, right? Or were you there?
I was there.
You were there, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
It did sound good.
It sounded really good.
Right.
Break a leg.
Yeah, right. Well, anyway, let's talk about William James, and we're in the middle. Well, not the, we're nearing the end of the varieties of religious experience, and the first thing we covered was, I don't even need this computer. I didn't even need to bring it. The first thing we covered was the first three chapters, which are sort of an introduction to the whole thing, where he tries to define religion, basically. And then I think the big picture is he has two major contrasts between types of religion that he wants to go over. And the first one, and these are my terms, by the way, but they fit. The first is between optimistic and pessimistic religion. And I would certainly say that BUMC is of the former ilk, right? Optimistic. We don't even like to talk about the stuff we're going to be singing about this morning, you know. Dies irae, et cetera, et cetera. And every one of them is depressing. if you look at the titles, you know, Kyrie, Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy, et cetera. And then the dies irae, save wrath. And what's after that? Confutatis, valedictis. And then it's the one
The Lacrimosa.
Well, right before that is
Rex.
Rex. Mm-hmm. Tremendi. Magistat. Well, we're not doing Roman Latin.
Mean?
We're doing the.
You said they're depressing. What do they mean?
Well, that one, king, all powerful king of majesty. I mean, you're up here, and I'm just this measly wreck. Down here, and then the Lacrimosa, the tears and wailing and so forth. So, I mean, he died after the Lacrimosa, and so virtually all the, I don't remember the various movements after the Lacrimosa. I'd have to cheat and look it up. But certainly everyone that we're doing is depressing if you look at the words. But
they
the music
don't have
is fun.
The words, though. If the system is working, apparently they're having trouble.
Oh, really?
But okay. If the system's working, they're going to have the translation.
Yeah. So
Mozart write the words?
No, they're traditional Requiem words.
Okay.
Yeah. But some of the, they're not as nice I came across somehow the other day the In Paradiso from the forest.
Right. Well, you
see, and they and the Durafle too.
Yeah.
Has a very nice ending.
Yeah.
This one.
Mm. Well, you see, the Durafle, a foray, and Durafle.
Well, this does have an on use at the end.
Uh huh.
But he didn't write it, so we're
right.
not saying it.
Durafle and Foray, though, or Foray and Durafle, took it upon themselves to emphasize the positive, and so they have movements that are much more uplifting than the traditional Requiem movements. But the, you know, the first one is, you know, eternal rest grant them, O Lord, blah blah blah, quite a long thing. But Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy, you know, and then the day of wrath is, you know, Deaceri, and the day of grief shall change the world to glowing ash, and as David and Sybil tell, how great quakening shall there be when on that day the judge shall come and weigh each man's deeds in detail. Street day. The trump, and then the trumpet shall sound, etc. King of fearful majesty, etc. And then the Lacrima Confitatis. When sentence on the damned is passed, and all the piercing flames are sent among the blessed, call my name, etc. Day of tears, Lacrimosa, is that dread day on which shall rise from ash and dust to judgment each true guilty man.
Huh.
So we're ending up with the
Abbeville there, does it, Don? Hmm? Doesn't sound real Jamesian.
No, it's not very Jamesian, and that's the point. It's also not very B-U-M-C-E-N. So, I mean, all that by way of that's this Jamesian contrast between pessimistic, a la the Requiem, mm-hmm. and optimistic religion a la B-U-M-C-ism. And then the second contrast that we went over last week, was between a religion of the heart and the religion of the head, right? And certainly one of the other Jamesian characteristics is the former is far more decisive than the latter. The latter is very puny compared to the former. Most religious people, well, for that matter, most maybe even a lot of atheists are so because of the heart rather than the head. The head's not going to get you very far. And he winds up, in fact, he's so extreme on it that he winds up saying, well, the only good the head is going to do for religion is as a second order philosophy or historical or psychology of whatever religion. In other words, talking about religion rather than trying to somehow justify some sort of religious perspective, which is, but of course he's inconsistent, as romantics usually are. I classify him as a romantic. He probably wouldn't like it, but I do. Because when we get to the end, we are going to hear what he has to say about first order religious belief, and then the pluralistic universe. The last work of James we're going to cover is along the same lines. So it's not as though he sticks to his own prescription and just being talking about religion, but the variety of religious experience is certainly mostly about religion. So most of it, except for the last little part of it, is you know, agrees with what he says one should be doing if one is an intellectual. Anyway, but the two things I thought we could cover this morning, and as I say, I'm going to cut it short because those of us in the choir really do have to get over there. The two things I'm going to talk about this morning are conversion and saintliness. So this is sort of outside the contrast that he's been doing, but they are topics of interest if you want to understand religion. So starting with conversion, he begins by talking about three kinds of conversion, I guess. And so here are the three ways in which conversion can happen, according to William James. Number one, ordinary alterations of character as we pass from one of our aims to another are not commonly called transformations, because each of them is so rapidly succeeded by another in the reverse direction. But whenever one aim grows so stable as to expel definitively its previous rivals from the individual's life, we tend to speak of the phenomenon, and perhaps to wonder at it, as a transformation. These alterations are the completest of the ways in which a self may be divided. A less complete way is the simultaneous coexist. This is the first. This is getting into the first one. The simultaneous coexistence of two or more different groups of aims, of which one practically holds the right of way and instigates activity, whilst the others are only pious wishes and never practically come to anything. So the first kind of conversion would be one in which, oh, I don't know, you sort of have a divided self, I guess, and you have these two ways of looking at the world, perhaps. And one is dominant, and the other is, let's say, recessive, you know. But the conversion experience then would be when they flip-flop, and the other one becomes dominant, and the first one becomes recessive. He goes on to talk about Augustine, and, you know, Augustine's prayer about, you know, make me chaste and continent, but not yet. And so, and of course, the way Augustine portrays it in the Confessions is as a divided self. I mean, he did and did not want to become what he thought was necessary to become a Christian. But then, after the garden episode in Milan and so forth, and it just everything flip-flopped, and he was able then to be chaste and continent. Not that, though, he forgot his former self. So the dominant and recessive frameworks reverse themselves. So that's conversion type number one. Okay. Then type number two. Let us hereafter, in speaking of the hot place in a man's consciousness, the group of ideas to which he devotes himself and from which he works, call it, quote, this is all quote, but this is italicized, the habitual center of his personal energy. It makes a great difference to a man whether one set of his ideas or another be the center of his energy, and it makes a great difference as regards any set of ideas which he may possess, whether they become central or remain peripheral to him. I'll comment just a second. To say a man is converted means, in these terms, that religious ideas previously peripheral in his consciousness now take a central place, and that religious aims form the habitual center of his energy. I think the difference between this and number one is, well, this you wouldn't call the second one a divided self, right? Because the other ideas are peripheral. It may be a difference of degree, I suppose. But the divided self, like Augustine, was truly tortured. I mean, he was inner turmoil because before he converted, he genuinely did want to become what in his eyes was a Christian, but he also genuinely wanted to have sex and, you know, to live a, we think, a normal life. But anyway, so you can't say that either of the two frameworks was peripheral in his case. They were both vying, but he was giving his allegiance to one of the two. Okay. Here, though, it's a little different because now the framework that you wind up converting to is just sort of out there in the nebulous the clouds of our consciousness, and not on terra firma, so to speak. But all of a sudden, for some reason, what was formerly just in the penumbra becomes the focus, and the focus, I guess, switches to the penumbra, something like that.
I have to say, Don, number two sounds like a psychologist.
Yeah, of course. Well, it's going to get more so as we get through.
A psychologist that he was. You know, like, you go to counseling, well, Don, you need to think more about this and less about that. You know, you need to rebalance, you know, bring this thing, you know.
Yeah.
Like, think more positive thoughts instead of being such a drag.
Yeah,
all
right.
All that kind of stuff to try to rebalance. Mm-hmm. I mean, that to me sounds like James.
I can see that. Yeah, sure, I can see that.
There's more to come, huh?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I thought you were... Yeah, well, quite a bit is coming up about the subconscious, but
where things don't go away, you just sort of reorient yourself.
Yeah, well, number three. Now, this number three is super dramatic. I mean, this is the one that maybe we think about a lot when we think about conversion, even more dramatic than number one. I mean, Augustine certainly presents his conversion as dramatic, but this one's even more so. In the end, we fall back on the hackneyed symbolism of a mechanical equilibrium. A mind is a system of ideas, each with the excitement it arouses and with tendencies impulsive and inhibitive, which mutually check or reinforce one another. The collection of ideas alters by subtraction or by addition in the course of experience, and the tendencies alter as the organism gets more aged, or aged, as my, I don't know, what do we say? My parents were from North Carolina, and they always said, what was the word? Check it. They didn't say check it, but they did do a lot of ED kind of things. They would have said aged. Do we say aged up here? Or do we say aged? I don't even know. I would say aged because I got it from my parents. So anyway, the mind becomes more aged.
In this context.
What was that?
In this context, aged sounds.
Okay, yes. Good. Okay. A mental system may be undermined or weakened by this increased alteration, just as a building is, and yet for a time keep upright by dead habit. But a new perception, a sudden emotional shock, or an occasion which lays bare the organic alteration will make the whole fabric fall together. And then the center of gravity sinks into an attitude more stable for new ideas that reach the center in the rearrangement seem now to be locked there, and the new structure remains permanent. So, I mean, this is the very dramatic one where, because of, I don't know, external things like war, maybe, or things that, crises that happen in your life, you lose a job, you get divorced, death of a loved one, all sorts of things, you know.
This is the sixth soul, isn't it?
Well, could be, but not necessarily. I mean, that chapter titled The Sixth Soul is simply what I'm calling, pessimistic religion,
right, yes.
Where God is in control of every little detail, and including evil. I mean, that's why he thinks of it as sick, yes, and pessimistic. But I'm talking about, or he's talking about, just traumatic, or psychological trauma, I suppose you could say, which can indeed affect your whole effect a brand new worldview. It doesn't have to, but it might, and sometimes that does happen because of psychological trauma. And so, somebody who was
diagnosed.
Neutral.
Somebody who's diagnosed with cancer, for example.
Right. Maybe some.
Have it.
Right.
People change immediately.
Yeah.
Well, there's the old.
Perspective and values and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's rearranged.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Tom?
Like the old battlefield conversion.
Yeah. 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 That kind of thing, too.
Metaphor, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
But he's acting like it. That sort of an experience is more likely to lead to a stronger belief.
Well,
rather than, because you hear of plenty of people whose child dies, mm-hmm, and they lose their faith,
Right, right.
If there's a God, how
no,
could he
I mean,
do this?
This is conversion in general. So, I guess he's obviously thinking about the stronger belief part of it, but it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, a shock to the system can result in any sort of rearrangement of the structures of the mind, so to speak. I'm reminded of Thomas S. Kuhn. I don't know why. This is very much like Kuhn's idea of science and the structure of scientific revolutions. I cited him just the other day. Oh, it was in Hegel class, I think. And Kuhn has this idea. There is this period, long, long period, which he calls normal science, where a paradigm reigns, everybody sees the world the same way, and everybody, all the experts agree, and so forth and so on. But there are always going to be little anomalies in your data, and you do observations and whatever don't exactly line up, but you usually think of it, well, okay, just something wrong with the instruments maybe, or was careless in recording it, or probably some error somewhere. And his point is, well, eventually those anomalies accumulate and accumulate and accumulate, and at some point the shock occurs, and it's like knocking the props off the building, and the whole building, like when you demolition, the whole thing collapses. And then you have chaos for a while. All sorts of alternative theories are promulgated and so forth. And then something takes hold eventually and becomes the new paradigm. And once again, we have a long period of stability until the next overthrow and so forth. Well, it's very much like that, you know. So this huge shock, which causes the ramparts to collapse and the structure to completely, you know, be obliterated, and it's replaced by something else. And so this is much more dramatic. I'm sure you could probably argue that all three maybe we're talking about differences of a degree here. I don't know. He goes on, by the way, in the same vein. Emotional occasions, especially violent ones, are extremely potent at in precipitating mental rearrangements. Very much like Kuhn, you know, mental rearrangements. The sudden and explosive ways in which love, jealousy, guilt, fear, remorse, or anger can seize upon one are known to everybody. Hope, happiness, security, resolve, emotions, characteristic of conversion, can be equally explosive, and emotions that come in this explosive way seldom leave things as they found them. So you get the point, I'm sure. Okay. Well, the rest of the discussion about conversion hinges on the value, I guess, the value of conversion. So I'm going to put in my notes. Let me just check my what I said. Yeah, the value of conversion. What do we hope to get out of it, or what positive kinds of things can come from it? And this is where it gets more into the, well, it will at least get more into the subconscious murky realm. It goes on. He says, now there are two forms of mental occurrence in human beings which lead to a striking difference in the conversion process, which Professor Starbuck has called attention. You know how it is when you try to recollect we've talked about this, a forgotten name. Right? Usually you help the recall by working for it, by mentally running over the places, persons, and things with which the word was connected. But sometimes this effort fails, and you feel then as if the harder you tried, the less hope there would be, as though the name were jammed and pressure in its direction only kept it all the more from rising. And then the opposite expedient often succeeds. Give up the effort entirely. Think of something altogether different, and in half an hour, the lost name comes sauntering into your mind, as Emerson says, as carelessly as if it had never been invited. Some hidden process was started in you by that effort, which went on after, and that's certainly true, after the effort ceased, and made the result come as if it had come spontaneously. A certain music teacher, says Dr. Starbuck, says to her pupils after a... And I've heard this before, too. I think David Fanning used to say this. After the thing to be done has been clearly pointed out and unsuccessfully attempted, the two teachers simply said, stop trying and it will do itself. Uh-huh. And there is a lot of truth to that. I mean, when you've mastered something, like a musical instrument or just a lot of things, if you start thinking about it, it just screws things up, right? Yeah. But if you've really mastered what you're trying to do, you should not even think about it. And it'll just happen. I mean, the muscle memory, I don't know what it is, but anyway. So in other words, there's a lot going on there. And we've become, I think, much more appreciative of that of late, in the last 30 years maybe. There's a lot going on there that is not part of consciousness, you know? I mean, our right brain is not conscious. Our left brain is conscious. And, you know, I've talked in here before, haven't I, about blindsight and the experiments they did where it would just go to the right brain and they'd ask them to guess what was being seen. And they could pretty much guess right about it, even though they weren't conscious of seeing anything. So there's something going on there. There is, thus, a conscious and voluntary way, an involuntary and unconscious way in which mental results may get accomplished, and we find both ways exemplified in the history of conversion going on, giving us two types, which Starbuck calls the volitional type and the type of by self-surrender, respectively. So that's what gets us this distinction he wants to make between voluntary, in other words, conscious conversion versus I just, you know, give up and it just something just takes over. Just kind of like when you're trying to recollect the name and you can't do it, and then all of a sudden it just pops into your mind. So that's the distinction here. Okay, two types of conversion. As our mental fields, I think this is the next one, yeah. As our mental fields succeed one another, each has its center of interest around which the objects of which we are less and less attentive, attentively conscious, fade into a margin so faint that its limits are unassignable. Now here's an experiment that he's talking about. In certain subjects, I don't know if this is back to Starbuck or who the experimenter is, but anyway, in certain subjects, at least, there is not only the consciousness of the ordinary field, which he mentioned earlier, with its usual center and margin, but in addition thereto, in the shape of a set of memories, thoughts, and feelings, which are extra marginal and outside of the primary consciousness altogether, but yet must be classified as conscious facts of some sort, able to reveal their presence by unmistakable signs. So this is getting back to that same distinction between what's in the periphery and what's not. The most important consequence of having a strongly developed ultra-marginal life of this sort is that one's ordinary fields of consciousness are liable to incursions from it of which the subject does not guess the source, and which therefore take for him the form of unaccountable impulses to act, or inhibitions of action, of obsessive ideas, or even of hallucinations of sight and hearing. The impulses may take the direction of automatic speech or writing, the meaning of which the subject himself may not understand even while he utters it. And generalizing this phenomenon, Mr. Myers, that's who he's talking about, has given the name of automatism. Sensory or motor, emotional or intellectual, to this whole sphere of efforts due to uprushes in the ordinary consciousness of energies originating in the subliminal parts of the mind. See? So, I mean, I guess this would describe the non-volitional type, what did he call the non-volitional type? Or maybe he didn't give a name to it. Oh, yeah, the self-surrender. That's what it was. So, in other words, this idea that things that that happen, or I should say, conversion experiences that you can't quite explain how that all happened, how it all came to you, because it wasn't something you consciously were doing, can be explained by this phenomenon of the unconscious, which is far vaster than our conscious experience.
Let's take Marty's example of someone who had faith and no longer has it.
Right.
So I guess what he would argue is that you wouldn't see where, you know, you're going along fairly consistent, and then over a short time, you just change your mind completely. Mm-hmm. He would argue that whether you realize it or not, you were probably churning away in your subconscious, mm-hmm. heading along that path. Mm-hmm. And you may have had some little steps where you consciously, like, you know, I don't feel like going to church anymore.
Right.
But I still pray or whatever, right?
Right.
You know, so you go, ding, versus the... But even so, unless there's an extreme event, your mind is churning in that direction,
yeah.
Probably.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, you can align this with the three distinctions he makes first, the three types of conversion, right? Now, the first one, where the divided self, I think that's pretty much in your conscious mind. I'm aware of both, like Augustine was, right? The second one was this thing about the periphery. That may still be conscious, but you're kind of edging into something that's not quite so conscious. But then that third one, which is, yeah, boom, and everything gets rearranged. Well, very likely that's from the unconscious, I would think. That's a good way to think about it. Remember I said you could think of those as matters of degree rather than matters of kind, and maybe you could put them on a continuum in exactly that way. So the first one is a split conscious, left brain kind of thing. Second one is that a peripheral set of ideas is sort of barely on the conscious, or maybe on the boundary, say. And then the third one, when you know, you get hit over the head, that's welling up from the unknown depths.
Because, you know, I was thinking about, you know, you mentioned your parents from the North Carolina.
Yeah.
So, you know, they grew up in a segregated South.
Yeah.
You know, and various problems that have
changed.
And so I wonder, you know, if you did a study of, say, their generation of Southerners, did they suddenly wake up one day and say, you know, the world's changed? No. You know, they were probably had a lot of subconscious going on, too.
You know, I could tell you about my father. I thought about this a lot. I got some hair right. Where is it?
just fix it before choir, Don. Or you'll be, what's up with Don up there?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Well, that's all right. You know,
there's nobody there.
There's nobody on anyway. So we're looking at the ceiling right now, but it's a very nice view of the ceiling.
Sorry, my fault.
About your father, Don.
Yeah, so, don't worry about it. Just, that's okay. I imbibed a good bit of racism when I was a kid. I certainly did. I mean, and my father, one thing I remember was we would drive through Rock Creek Park. And I will not repeat the words my father used exactly, but he would always complain that blacks had taken over the park, you know, because, well, they lived in the city and, you know, that was some green space they could go to, for goodness sake. And even as a little kid, I do remember thinking, well, why does that mean you can't go and find some little spot of that you can enjoy, you know, that's not being occupied? But in his mind, you see, right, separate but equal, right? That's what he had in his head. And so if the blacks were there, the whites were not there, and vice versa, right? And, you know, that's the way it just, that's just the way it was. But, of course, he changed. I mean, I wouldn't say he became some sort of flaming whatever, leftist by any means, but he did. Human beings can change. They can, they can think through things, and they can see, oh, this is not good. I was making some sort of assumption that I hadn't thought about. But if you think about it, you know, duh. And he tried to be equitable and, you know, and fair and colorblind and all that sort of thing. I can't say that he was 100%, but I don't think I'm 100% either, so who am I to talk?
But he didn't someday wake up a different person.
No. No, it was a more gradual...
It just wasn't possible.
It was a more gradual kind of thing. It might have been, how would you classify it? Maybe number type 2, maybe? Where at the periphery, maybe a little bit nagging doubt that maybe this isn't right. But this is the way, but wait, well, consciously, go ahead, Jay.
Rearrangement of the mental.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And or a sequence of modest conversions.
Yes, yes, I think that's
like
fair.
The park is not the same as working with people or something. You know, maybe you say, oh, that's okay, that's okay, that's okay, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
As a series of conversions.
Yeah, that's probably a good way
or
of describing.
Or sort of like Marty's example, a series of things where you fall away from the church, perhaps.
True. And maybe that's even more common than some sort of dramatic kind of switch. Who knows? But it's instructive how my mother had this false idea of psychology. She used to say, my mother had these very, what's the right word, Patty? You know, just sort of fixed, idea. Well, I'll give you the example. She used to say, You are malleable until you turn 25. And I honestly think she thought the minute you celebrate your 25th birthday, you are set in stone. I mean, and that's...
So don't argue with me, Don.
Yeah.
I'm over 25.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. So, okay, she didn't believe in the constant change
right.
of people as we grow older that we can always
yes.
change.
Yes, yes. I mean, why are you in the Sunday school class if you right. didn't think that right. there was some change that was possible? Right. Otherwise, why bother?
Yeah, why are you getting that PhD? You're over 25.
yeah. So, yeah. So, I mean, I think my father is a good example of that.
I think you'd find most, you know, I can't think of a case, and I doubt many people can, where suddenly they decided they were one day a completely different person, just like that.
Yeah.
On any subject.
Right.
I don't really think.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. My father as a paradigm is much, much, much more common than the dramatic Augustinian kind of switch, you know. But yeah, that's a good thing to point out. I'm not going to get to saintliness. Let me read you one last quote, and then I'm going to stop because they were starting to practice at 10:15, and but you know, he did say if you're teaching Sunday school, you don't have to be there at 10:15. So that's okay. I'm always late to choir. But anyway, but let me read you this one last quote, and then we'll call it a day. The lower manifestations of the subliminal, indeed, fall within the resources of the personal subject. His ordinary sense material, inattentively taken in and subconsciously remembered and combined, will account for all his usual automatisms. But just as our primary wide awake consciousness throws open our senses to the touch of things material, so it is logically conceivable that if there be higher spiritual agencies that can directly touch us, well, you're going with this, where is the spiritual sense, so to speak? We have our five senses. Mm-hmm. Well, in the Byzantine tradition, well, even in the earlier pre-Byzantine, there is this idea of the spiritual senses, analogous to our normal senses. Well, that's kind of where he's going. He doesn't use that terminology, but this, in other words, there is an organ in the brain. If there's anything to this at all, there's an organ in the brain that is a spiritual sense. It would be in the unconscious part of the brain, I guess. Anyway, but if there be higher spiritual agencies that can directly touch us, the psychological condition of their doing so might be our possession of a subconscious region which alone should yield access to them. So that's what I'm calling the spiritual sense. The hubbub of the waking life might close a door which in the dreamy subliminal might remain ajar or open. Thus, that perception of external control, which is so essential a feature in conversion, might in some cases at any rate be interpreted as the orthodox interpreted, that forces transcending the finite individual might impress him on condition of his being what we may call a subliminal human specimen. So in other words, if there's anything at all to this idea of a spiritual world that somehow can influence us, there must be an organ, quote-unquote, by which we, quote-unquote, sense the whatever's coming from that spiritual world, and that, quote-unquote, organ would have to exist in the subliminal region of the brain, in the unconscious part of the brain. This is part of his Neoplatonism, as I call it. I think it's an interesting idea. Anyway, that's conversion. And so next week, then, we'll talk about saintliness, and we may or may not get to the very last topic, which I've called his own more fully fledged Neoplatonism. So we'll do that next week.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Much.
Thank you.